Stoller especially tried to build a firewall between sex, which he then considered to be everything that biology had to do with the world, and gender, which was everything culture and psychology and upbringing had to do with the world. But what's pretty clear when you really dig into the biology is that gender is always changing the biology.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. The following episode is part of the Making Sense of Sex and Gender series on this podcast. In this series, we try to make sense of the distinction between sex and gender, and cover trans issues in a very thoughtful and nuanced fashion. We have balanced discussions from multiple perspectives, including scientists, activists, and a leading feminism scholar. This series will hopefully expand your mind and help you make sense of the current heated debate surrounding the distinctions between sex and gender, as well as transgender issues. The aim is to turn down the temperature on this very heated topic and increase understanding and integrate truth with love. I hope you will listen to this entire series with an open mind and an open heart. And as always, we look forward to hearing your feedback and comments on our website and on the YouTube channel. So without further ado, I bring you this episode within the Making Sense of Sex and Gender series. Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Dr. Anne Fausto-Sterling on the show. Dr. Fausto-Sterling is the Nancy Duke Lewis Professor Emerita of Biology and Gender Studies in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology and Biochemistry at Brown University. Say that 10 times real fast. Her books and scholarly articles are referenced widely in feminist and scientific inquiries. She has received grants and fellowships in both the sciences and the humanities, and in 2020, she re-released her book called Sexing the Body: Gender Politics and the Construction of Sexuality with Updated Research. In this episode, I talked to Dr. Fausto-Sterling about gender/sex and the body. During the 60s, the term, quote, gender was introduced to make a distinction between a person's biology and psychology. But Dr. Fausto-Sterling believes that these can never really be separate. She argues that biology influences gender, but that the opposite is also true. Culture and context can influence our hormones and body systems. We also touch on the topics of gender dysphoria, feminism, intersexuality, trans issues, and child development. This was a really stimulating conversation with a legend in the feminist scholarly space. I really like how Dr. Fausto-Sterling brings in the science and tries to integrate that with the work she does in terms of feminism scholarship. So this was a great integration of multiple fields, and I hope you find this conversation as rich and stimulating as I did. So without further ado, I bring you Dr. Anne Fausto-Sterling. Hey, Anne, thank you so much for being on the Psychology Podcast today.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. You are a... Well, actually, I want you to introduce yourself before I tell the audience that I was going to call you a legendary feminist and scholar, but why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit how you would sort of... What sort of identities would you put on yourself?
Okay, well, I'm a retired professor of biology and gender studies. I taught for over 40 years at Brown University, where I was instrumental in starting gender studies at Brown and in a time when gender studies was just starting up nationally. It wasn't a thing until we made it a thing. And at the same time, because I'm trained as a biologist and scientist, I have always been interested in the topic of biology and gender, and also in how science works. So after I wrote my first book called Myths of Gender, I became very aware that scientists, even really famous, really smart ones like Charles Darwin, they did their science always in their historical and cultural context. And so they had a pre-existing view of gender that they used to organize scientific knowledge that they came about. So the field of science and technology studies became a field that was really important to me to understand how our culture and our ways of seeing the world that pre-exist our science become part of our science in a way that few people question it. So I also founded at Brown the Science and Technology Studies Program, which is broader. It deals with scientific knowledge in many arenas, and it is still a thriving program, I'm happy to say.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
At what point in your life did you, like, how did the feminism and the biology interests, how did those things get linked with you? What's can you trace the development of that thinking within you a little bit?
So they really got, the science and feminism got, and biology got linked because of my political activism. In the late 60s and early 70s, I was active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. I was active in the civil rights movement. And then as the women's feminist movement began to explode, I naturally joined that as well. But and then I was studying biology, which was always an enthusiasm of mine. And I was a young professor in the early 1970s. And my feminist friends started realizing, as did I, that one of the arguments against feminism, against equal rights for women, that was being used time and again was an argument based on the idea that women were biologically different, or, depending on who was saying it, inferior to men. And that somehow they didn't have the aggression, the know-how, the whatever, to become really competent in the public sphere. And I say this at a moment when the newly announced president of Harvard University is first time a person of color, and for the second time, a woman. But that would have been just unimaginable in the 1970s. But my friends turned to me as a biologist and as sort of to say, well, what about these biological arguments? Do they make any sense? Are they true? What should we think about them? And I honestly hadn't thought about them very much. So that's when I decided to use my skills as a biologist to dig into the background of these claims. And that's what led me to write my first book, Myths of Gender. And as they say, the rest is history.
Would you say that that most of the ideas and myths of gender hold up today? Are there any that don't hold up? Just looking back on that, where are we at right now with a lot of the claims you made in there?
The arguments I made against the biological claims, I think, hold up today. They probably, some of them people would just laugh at today. Others people still wonder about. They would be worded differently today. And I think our whole notion of science has really changed in ways that are both good and bad today. I think the book is still relevant, and it's quite amazing to me, since it came out originally in 1985, a second edition in 1993, that the publisher still has it in print. So it's still available. So it must be meaning,
that is really impressive.
Meaning something to some people.
Wouldn't that be something if any of my books 40 years from now, 30 years from now, we're still in print? So
yeah,
huge congratulations there.
Thank you.
Well, something that strikes me about you is you're obviously very interested in science. You're interested in activism. You have such a knowledge of the history of the psychology. I mean, this is the psychology podcast, so forgive
right.
me if I focus
right.
on psychology a little bit. But I'm amazed at the breadth of knowledge you have about how certain terms came to be in what years, and sort of a broader context of the scientific investigation of things through like the DSM and stuff. So can you actually walk our listeners through some things, and I can prompt it so we can go in pieces here, but it would be really helpful, I think, for our listeners to hear a little bit about the evolution of a lot of the terms that we're seeing today, such as transgender. But let's go back, you know, to like the turn of the 20th century. Invert, transvestite, eonist, I've never heard eonist, E-O-N-I-S-T, and sex were the most predominant words used for in the sex and gender domain, right? Is that correct? From the 1900s, 1940s?
Right. So at the turn of the 20th century, group of people who we now, I think, call sexologists were trying to understand sexual expression and its many forms. They came out of a point of view in which they assumed that there was a normal state of being that was what we would today call binary, that they assumed that there were men and there were women, and there was an underlying heterosexual assumption in there, what today we would call heteronormative, that is, that healthy men desired women and healthy women desired men. The big compendium was first written in the late 1800s by Krafft Ebing, was called Psychologia Sexualis, and it was based on a notion on looking at everything that he considered sexual pathology, that is, things that were not normal. And it involved all sorts of sexual expression, some of which we can't imagine even exist today, but some of which are very much with us, but quite normalized, like homosexuality. And his work was that book was originally published in German. It did get translated into English. It was taken up by another sort of pioneer sexologist, Havelock Ellis, an Englishman working in the first part of the 20th century. And he wrote definitive books on homosexuality. And again, he considered it to be an abnormality or an unhealthy form of development. But both Krafft-Ebing and Ellis and others who wrote as similar modes had homosexuality and transsexuality kind of all what we would we consider these separate terms today. They had them all joined together in their minds. So they considered a homosexual man, Ellis used the term invert to say that he somehow was psychologically inverted so that his brain was more like a woman's, which made him desire a man, if you can follow me, but also might make him want to cross-dress and dress as a woman. And that would make him what we would today call a transsexual, to the extent that none of these people had distinguished people who were heterosexual but cross-dressed from people who were homosexual but cross-dressed from people who, as today we would argue, have a gender identity that makes them feel like they are a woman inside a man's body. The notion of gender identity really didn't become part of the conversation until the 1950s and 60s. So these terms,
right.
There were terms, Ionist was named after a French count from the, I think, 17th century, somebody, D'Eon, who cross-dressed or who may be presented as a woman. And there are a couple of books out on him, but that's where the term Ionism, it's a completely unknown term today. Although if you Google it, you'll find it. If you haven't, you may have. But it was really in the 1950s and 1960s that John Money and also psychiatrist Robert Stoller began to feel, and all of these terms were described under the term sex, but they began to feel that the term sex just got people, as the only term to describe everything they were talking about, got people confused. And furthermore, sex also could mean eroticism. So it wasn't just how you presented yourself in the world or what you thought about your body, but it also had always other possible meanings involving attraction and types of sexual pleasure. So Money decided that sex was trying to, as a single word, was trying to do too much. And so he decided to try to divide things up, and he didn't invent the term gender, but he took it away from a grammatical thing and used it as, introduced it as a psychological term. And he introduced the notion of identity, that is how you felt about yourself. And Stoller elaborated on that, and there was a sudden, I'm writing a book on this right now, I did an engram, which is a study of it's just a quick and dirty thing that Google lets you do, looking at the frequency of measurements in, the frequency of words appearing in books over time, and there's nothing for gender identity, it's flat, 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 and then about 1960 it starts to go up, and then it just zooms right up, and it's now a very current term. So it didn't exist before then.
Yeah.
You can do it if you've ever done an engram. You can pop the term gender identity in there, and you'll stay.
I saw the one you came up with, which is good enough. I trust you.
Okay.
I saw the one you did, and it's fascinating. You know, it's just interesting to think that in the 50s and 60s, this term gender, but not gender identity, but gender as separate from sex was the main sort of thing defining that epoch. And then in the 80s, you do see the gender identity, but you see gender identity used in a psychopathological way. Correct me if I'm wrong, but when I look at the analysis you did around the 80s, it started to terms like gender identity disorder the word disorder,
starts
to creep in there, and gender identity disorder of childhood as well starts to creep in there. So that's something new, right, that you start to see around the 80s?
That's all due to psychiatrists developing this.
Good old psychiatrists.
Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illness. And the DSM became a thing that psychiatrists started making in the 1950s and became sort of solidified in the 60s and 70s as a way of standardizing or trying to standardize mental illness in general, so that it gave the psychiatrist control and a sort of authority over, and this is where the science studies comes in. It was part of a struggle for authority over who could gets to say who's mentally ill, who's and who gets to tell an insurance company whether they should pay for treatment, that kind of thing. And the insurance companies very much wanted this too, because they had no way of dealing with the variety of presentations of mental disease, much broader than things having to do with gender. Gender is a tiny subset of what's in the DSM. But third edition of the DSM for the first time began to have homosexuality listed. But by that time, there was a gay rights movement, and there was a strong movement among psychiatrists, too, to remove homosexuality as a mental illness, to get it out of the DSM and to put it up parallel to heterosexuality as just one of multiple ways of being in the world. And so DSM had homosexuality in there, and then also there were psychiatrists who were specialized in sexology were starting to see a lot of children who were brought to them by their parents because the parents didn't think the children were behaving in gender-appropriate ways. So there were little boys who liked to play with dolls and little girls who wanted to climb trees, and the parents were upset by this. And this is where so to the extent that they were brought by parents who couldn't tolerate those behaviors to psychiatrists wanted a category, and this is where the childhood gender identity disorders came into being. But that childhood gender identity disorder, every time DSM rewrote itself, which was about every decade, the classification and diagnosis changed because it was just never a stable thing. So it raised and fell. And there is a new one which still has a very mild version of it in it. And I predict that when we're now with DSM-5, by the time we get to DSM-6, I think it's going to be gone. And it's also going to be considered in the realm of behaviors that may cause distress to the child because of poor reception by the rest of the world or by the child's parents, but isn't considered a pathology on the individual child's part.
Just to clarify, are you talking about gender dysphoria? You think that'll be out of the DSM?
I think gender dysphoria will be out of the DSM as a disease. So I'm just, you know, knock on wood, I'm still alive in 10 years. Check with me and we'll see if I'm right, because there will be. They already modified the 2020 DSM to try and clarify gender dysphoria as being something that's not inherent in the child, but rather may be the result of the world impinging on the child. So I think it's also a word that's with us right now, and it's a real experience for a lot of trans people, don't get me wrong. But the question is, what is the origin of the experience and what are the better ways to deal with it? And whether dealing with it is sending a child to a psychiatrist, I think is what's at issue.
Yeah, gotcha. And relating to all this, I want to talk about another major milestone I noted. It's very interesting. You see the term transsexual is the predominant sort of trans word until looked like 2011 to me is the biggest spike. And I may be wrong, but it looked like that's when really the term transgender really kind of replaces the term transsexual. And you don't really see transsexual used as much after 2011. Is that roughly correct?
That's roughly correct. And again, transsexual began to be seen as being not quite the right coinage for a word coinage, because it suggested that it was about sex in that old-fashioned sense of the word. And once gender identity became an established idea, it became, a lot of people argued that whatever is trans, it has to do with gender and identity, not with sex or sexuality. But also in the, you know, decade plus since 2010, just the whole notion of non-binary has exploded, and the transsexual umbrella, if you will, has increased to include people who are for want of a better term, classic transsexual in the terms as they may be presented in 1950 as being quite binary. That is, and those were the rules if you wanted to get affirming surgery, for example, is that you had to really convince the surgeon and the psychologist that you really wanted to be a woman if you were born as a man, or vice versa. And today, things are a lot less binary, and transgender allows under its umbrella a lot broader range of existences.
Yeah, you were, I mean, a pioneer already in that. Let's give you some credit here. Well, you wrote a book called The Five Sexes. You already, you know, before this, you know, really got into the cultural consciousness that that gender and maybe even sex could be fluid in some way. You wrote this thesis, but I'm trying to understand what you still stand by today regarding that and what you don't, because you presented an original model in 1993, male, female, merm, firm, and herm, but it doesn't sound like that you stand by that now, or you are clarifying what you meant by that. Could you just clarify to me what you meant? Yeah.
Sure. I need to clarify it. And I also wrote an essay. I wrote that essay in 1993, and it kind of shocked a lot of people, and people still use it in the classroom, and it's sort of, it catches people's attention, catches people by surprise, which I think is a good thing in that it makes people stop and think. It was focused primarily on the question of intersexuality and the practice of that money pioneered of trying to make people who were born with as physical intersexes, that is, they had components of male and female parts in their bodies, trying to make them binary, usually through surgery, but also through a regime of trying to raise them as one or the other, either as a male or a female, with no space for just being what they were, which was something in between. So I wrote that essay as a provocative essay, sort of along the lines of the old Jonathan Swift Modest Proposal essay, which this generation, or many generations, I guess, aren't familiar with. It was a proposal about, in which he ironically proposed that we could deal with the overpopulation problem. This was an answer to Malthus, really. I mean, this is when it was written, by eating children. And no one really believed that he was arguing that we eat children, but understood that it was an ironic answer to the question of overpopulation. Similarly, there was a great deal of irony in my naming of these terms. And it still didn't do the work, I don't think, that needs to be done. And in fact, if we could have this interview in a year when I finish writing my final chapter, I'd have like a much neater answer for you, because I'm trying to work towards a theory of development that is more continuous or graded with regard to gender development. The Five Sexes is still, it's not dichotomous anymore, but it's still very disjoined. So you have just, you know, five things, no transitions between them. The things are based on making fun of the medical people who are still trying to hold on to a binary. So I think the essay now is still useful to make people stop and think, but it isn't where I'm trying to go right now, which is to come up with a theory of developmental psychology of human development, starting with infants, that looks as gender as something that develops along a continuum, if only we would allow it to.
Do you see there any valid distinction anymore between sex and gender? It sounds like you don't really see that as a valid distinction anymore. Is that right?
It's interesting. I've also come around to, and I'm not the only one, there are a few other people working in this field, scholars in this field, and we've invented a new term, just what we need, new term.
Sex gender?
Called gender/sex.
And, right, gender/sex.
Yeah. I run it together and I say gender sex. Mm. And we did this, I did this because it became apparent to me, money tried to build kind of a Stoller especially tried to build a firewall between sex, which he then considered to be everything that biology had to do with the world, and gender, which was everything culture and psychology and upbringing had to do with the world. But what's pretty clear when you really dig into the biology, is that gender is always changing the biology. You know, everything from studies of hormones that show that a soldier's testosterone drops precipitously just before they're entering into battle. So fear makes your testosterone drop. There are diurnal rhythms.
Having children well, makes men's testosterone drop.
Yeah, there's a whole series of new studies along those lines by some anthropologists interested in this that show how the testosterone of single young men who are looking for mates have a higher average testosterone than men who not only who have had children but who are actively parenting. So the act of actual physical nurturing.
You can see evolutionary reasons for that. You can see smart evolutionary pressures for that.
You can,
to
absolutely.
Take care of the child. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
So what you see are things that we've thought of as sort of true biological markers like testosterone and other hormones are not sort of independent constants, but they change with both they're different culturally, but they also change with the behavioral context which a person finds himself. And at the same time, if you think about, say, how gender in upbringing changes the actual biology, the examples of the one things like how much practice have you had throwing a ball that leads you to be able to, quote, throw like a boy? And in what culture have you had it? I have a colleague who's an anthropologist who studies capoeira, which is a very masculine considered martial arts form in Brazil. But the capoeiristas that he studies, if they do other sports at soccer, baseball is not a common sport for them. They, quote, throw like girls, according to what we would say in the United States. They've never practiced that kind of overarm throwing. And that's a long neuromuscular sensory response that you develop through practice and over time and with responses and even with very careful physical guiding. I mean, I've watched, and you can find it online, even if you images of learning to throw, in which usually it's a male figure, presumably a father, with a child literally leaning over them from behind, embracing them, and raising one arm to physically help them model the motor activity that is involved with overhand throwing. So that's gender on the one hand, wanting your son, usually, not always, but usually, to throw that way, and physically helping them learn the sensory motor motions, nerves that become permanently implanted in the nervous system. That's biology. So they aren't really separate. And there are very few things, I think, that exist that are, quote, pure biology, that are immune from cultural modification. And it's not just because you think you should do something, but it also has become imprinted within your neuromuscular system.
You know, I really want to make sure I understand your arguments today. They might differ from some of the assumptions I had. So let me just lay out some of the assumptions I had and let me know what your perspective is, how it's similar or different.
Good.
I was under the impression there's no such thing as a third sex, that there's, from an evolutionary point of view, sex is purely about reproductive function, and that's why it evolved, two gametes, two sexes, and that's it. But the gender, on the other hand, is something different, and it's merely a social construct and can be anything you want it to be if you believe in it, which some people don't, but that we are ultimately sexed bodies and everything else might be personality differences. So those are some foundational assumptions I had about the biology of sex, and that maybe there's a valid distinction between medical sex and evolutionary sex. And that could be an interesting level of nuance that we could talk about, where medical sex seems to be more complicated than just genitals because it involves hormones, chromosomes, and other sex organs, versus from a strictly why did sex evolve point of view for reproductive functions. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of that, because those are some of my assumptions, and tell me if you think I'm wrong.
Right. So even this is one of the problems Money had with the term sex and why he started dividing it up into kinds of sex. So, and also let's be clear that we're talking about humans. Not even all vertebrates have the kind of sex that humans have. So if you go out into the animal and plant world, you have 3 sexes, 4 sexes, 5 sexes. You have all sorts of things. You have environmental sex.
We're talking about humans.
Stipulate that we're talking about humans here.
Yes, please. Yes.
And we have money encountering, and this comes back from his work with intersex children and adults, encountering people who were born and identified and raised as women who might have a Y chromosome. So they might, or might have no second chromosome. They might be XO. Or you had men who have an extra X. And it turns out that these sex chromosome differences are actually surprisingly common. If you look at, you can find that out by looking at countries that keep universal birth registries, like the Scandinavian countries record the chromosomal composition of everybody at birth, and you find a lot of hidden differences that people don't even know exist. So he said, all right, we've got chromosomal sex, and that doesn't necessarily determine whether you're a man or a woman. And they said, well, but we have the fetal gonadal sex. We have the gonads developing during fetal development. And those start out as being bisexual. That is a young embryo prior to 6 weeks of after fertilization have undefined fetal gonads, and they have both sets of potential accessory organs. They have both the potential fallopian tubes in uterus, and they have the potential epididymis and those kinds of things. And then as development proceeds in one direction or another, due primarily to hormones the fetus produces, that's fetal hormonal sex, they begin to produce fetal gonads and have fetal gonadal sex, and so on. And he described about 5 different levels. And what was interesting to him and what he established is that they don't necessarily all agree with each other. So you can have somebody with one chromosomal sex and a different gonadal sex. And then they get identified at birth, basically in terms of their exterior gonads. And as long as those appear clear to a physician, they get called either a boy or a girl. And only if they're unclear to a physician do people investigate further and so forth. So what you choose to define as the sex that you want to refer to someone as or that they live their lives as within a generation may depend on any number of things, not necessarily the presence of eggs or sperm.
So that's so interesting. So is your argument that you would view intersex individuals, which is a very, very, very small percentage of the population, but they do exist and they are important. And of course, we don't want to say that just because they're a small part of the population that they're not important. But are you conceptualizing them as a different sex? Because some biologists would say they still fall within one of the two sexes among humans.
That's a tricky question because...
It is tricky.
Yeah, it is a tricky question. I would resist trying to categorize them. And this is also a really important turn in methodology. I would want to know how they would categorize themselves.
There's a whole new movement
of scholars who are studying intersex and transgender, non-binary individuals, in which rather than, say, going in with a questionnaire in which we've said, which are you, male, female, intersex, they're doing qualitative work to get categories defined by the people who are actually living them. And again, it might be a contextual category. You might say, how do you define yourself in terms of reproduction? So, and, you know, the phenomenon, again, it's rare, but now for quite well, you know, not so uncommon, of someone who's a female-to-male transgender who decides to have a baby. And so they stop taking hormones and become pregnant. So you have to ask, I think, understand how to address these categories, which we are now recognizing out in the open exist in the world. You may need to ask the people they involve, how they would consider themselves. So does that trans man who's having a baby, are they thinking themselves as the mother, as the father, as the parent? I think new language will evolve, but it's sort of, I don't think it's up to the biologist to say, well, we have these categories and here's the one you need to fit into. But rather we're recognizing that the original binary categories we have aren't working for a segment, even if it's a small set of people, and that we need new categories for an expansion.
That seems to be a major point that maybe let's double click on. It seems to be like there's an additional sort of care for inclusivity, a care for humanitarian belonging that is accompanying this 2011 onward sort of shift in language and things. I think that's what the heart of a lot of what you're getting at, because I'm trying to understand this from like a psychology. If you do look at psychology surveys, at least 99% of people, if you ask them their gender, it will match their gamete. You know, it will match their evolutionary sex. But I think what a lot of people are, maybe what you're saying, a lot of people, yours, and I want you to obviously tell me what you are actually saying. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me like there's something going on here where we're saying, well, there are a minority, but you know, they're being marginalized and they still matter, and we want to make sure that we can have them still be inclusive in our society, and maybe they've been neglected. Tell me your thoughts.
I'm going to make you a bet that if you did a survey of people between the ages of, say, 10 and 30, and you didn't say which of these categories do you put yourself into, but rather, how would you describe your sex? How would you describe your gender? What words would you use? That you would find probably a majority that said man or woman, but you would also, if you then added in the same question about gender, you would find probably 30 or 40 terms, because this has already been, I'm making you a bet, because studies like this have already been done.
Right. In this generation. So there's something
in this generation. Is redefining a couple of generations.
We're redefining everything.
redefining everything in these terms. And so if you do a preset survey in which you've already determined what the categories are, you may get that 99%. But if you do an open survey in which you say, you tell us what the categories are, you're going to get this huge range of answers. And I think that's very telling. That using qualitative open-ended methods is something that the psychologists and sociologists are learning how to do, and they need to get much better at it.
I hear you. I'm trying to think of so many different perspectives on the table. What are your thoughts on the feminists that are labeled TERFs, who believe that this is actually causing their women as a biological category to be erased, like their perspective? What do you make of their perspective?
Well, I've thought about this quite a lot. I hate the term,
sure you
TERF
have,
because it includes that term radical feminist, which has very specific historic meanings to me, but not to the modern generation. Mm-hmm. Though I don't use the term, but I've thought a lot about where that intense feeling is coming from. And one of the things it's coming from is, I think, actually a limitation on the part of feminists and feminism to being clear what it means about sex and gender. That is, feminism in the 70s and 80s really used those terms as a way of separating sex and biology, biology and culture, in order to make strong representations that we had to change culture to let women into the world. But by doing that, it did reinforce the notion that there is this underlying biology and that there is a single category called women that has some biological meaning. And I think what's happening now, and I'm guilty of that, I was certainly guilty of that in the 70s and 80s myself. I hadn't thought through those terms. Maybe it wasn't the moment to do it, although there were a few people who were raising those issues back then. But what's happening now is that there's the trans rights movement, and people who support them have move beyond this notion that there is a single biological category called women that makes political sense. And they're also moving towards inventing a new science of gender, which involves these kind of new methods we're talking about. Whereas the people who argue against transgender rights and the who grew up in this older feminist movement are clinging to a kind of static belief in science and clinging to biology as the way in which their identity has been defined. So to have that challenged is frightening to them and feels like going against many things that they've fought for, many of the rights they've fought for in the past. So I think there's developed two kind of incommensurate points of view about what gender is, where it comes from, and what women are. And right now, I don't see how to make them agree with one another. It's going to be an ongoing debate.
Yeah, I asked the artificial intelligence chatbot, "What is a woman?" And the way I was curious, how do they reconcile it? And they said both. They said it could be either biological female, identified at birth as female, or someone with a gender identity of female. What I guess I want to ask you is, don't you see there being a meaningful difference? And I don't know what the terminologies will end up being, but don't you see a difference between a biological female and someone? Like, for instance, if I were to say to you right now, I've just decided the second I'm now female and that's my identity, that's not exactly the same as a woman who has gone their whole life up to this point, you know, being treated as a female due to their biology. Do you not see that as a meaningful distinction? I think that's what a lot of TERFs are angry about.
I agree with you that it's not the same, but the question is how encompassing is or useful is the term woman in that sense? There's a new book out, I'll plug it, you may want to interview him, by Paisley Curra, C-U-R-R-A-H. They are a lawyer, they're in New York, he'd be easy to get, called Sex Is As Sex Does. And what they do is look at the categories of sex as defined in different aspects of the law. And what they argue is that it's completely functional. That is, sex is defined one way on a birth certificate, is defined a different way legally on a driver's license, and a third way in marriage law. And that the law doesn't have a consistent definition of sex if the law itself doesn't. And it's completely contextual. So what Curra argues is that we have to let go of this notion that there's a universal definition and learn to deal with multiple definitions in context. And so back to the bathroom question, for me, the counter question is, where is it safe and for whom to go to the bathroom?
Right.
And for that, you might actually use real data, not the scare stories that you see on Twitter, but you have to balance the possibility of assault. And what it comes down to, I did a little graphic on this. I haven't published it yet. I'm still working on it, in which you have the real danger as feared by women who are opposed to trans people using their bathrooms. They are scared of being assaulted by somebody with a penis. But on the other hand, trans women, they're also scared of being assaulted by people with penises if they go into a man's bathroom. So you have, you come down to, rather than worrying about who's a man and who's a woman in that context of use of public bathrooms, who is in danger and why? And which dangers are the real or frequent ones? And then how do we mitigate the danger? That cares for everybody. I mean, you've got to care for the whole group.
I really like that a lot. There seems to be a moral panic on the right. They don't view it as a moral panic, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not a moral panic, but that's just, I guess, the way I perceive it.
I'm totally cynical myself.
Fair enough. But specifically about surrounding bathrooms, sports, and I will say jails. I want to add jails to this because there are some good points I see some of them make. You know, I want to throw a bone, right, about specific instances of maybe a rapist who makes pretend that they're trans in order to get into a women's prison so they can commit more things. And I don't think I see it as a moral panic because I don't see that as a widespread thing. But it is. It does happen sometimes. We have to admit it does happen sometimes.
You know, terrible things have happened in the world. I agree with you. And there are bad people in the world. And the question is, do we make rules that govern all people in a category based on one bad person? I mean, if we wanted to do that, we'd be immobilized because any one of you and I both belong to categories of groups of people in which there are some bad people and some dangerous people. And what do? You avoid them. You try to get the police to deal with them. And in each of these cases, I mean, the right wing in the U.S. right now is just using this as a way of trying to steamroll people to vote for them. And to sort of make bona fides for themselves as being good right wingers. It's, as I say, I think it's totally cynical.
Cynical. Well, like, yes, this stuff is so politicized.
So you have someone in a jail who has a known record of being a rapist and of accomplishing rape by virtue of disguise, you know, of pretending to be transgender and gaining access. So what do? You can say, okay, everybody says I should believe you're trans, or you can say, look, I knew this record in front of me, and yes, maybe you'll be in danger in a men's prison, but that may be a solitary confinement for that person. I mean, a prison regime is a particularly terrible regime, and it's probably true to say that there are few prisons that are very well run up with that regard. So, I mean, I think I read one of these cases too, and that person that I read about had a long record. I mean, this was not a hidden thing about their behavior.
Right.
So why would you put them?
That doesn't seem like a good idea.
You're any other inmate.
Yeah, correct. It just doesn't seem like a good idea. Yeah, if they have a history of, no, absolutely. You know, there are like hot button issues, and I think I've made the case we need to really do a better job separating the issues that really are complicated and there are no easy answers. I don't think the thing in sports is just you snap your fingers and you answer what's best for everyone, what's fair for everyone. But issues that shouldn't be terribly controversial are if a trans individual wants to live their best life, and by living their best life, they change pronouns and maybe even as adults having surgery. Who am I to stand in that way? But then we talk about children, and then we get a hot button issue, right? But I think there's just some issues that, to me, as a society of dignity and humanitarianism, they shouldn't be controversial. But I see everything being lumped together as one big thing, and it becomes politicized, and it's frustrating. Is it frustrating you too?
It is. I mean, and scary to me too.
Mm.
And it's making, you know, it's really, and it's hurting people. That's the other thing. Mm. It's not hurting you or me, but it's hurting the people who are affected by these laws. I mean, I think both the question of how do you address gender non-conforming children, non-binary children, how do you address sports, they are more complicated. But again, if you address them contextually, I mean, sports allowing kids, 14-year-olds to play on the same sports team is a different question from who gets to participate in which group of professional sports, and even the internet
sports versus
right. So one thing is, how do you let a child, a 14-year-old, have sports activity and sports experience in their high school or junior high school or whatever we call it these days, middle school. That's what we'll call it. That's a different question than who gets to be on an Olympic team as a man or a woman. But even there, you know, the international sports people can't handle it because they have someone like Caster Semenya, who is a woman, has always been known as a woman, but who has a naturally high testosterone level. And this is where we get back to all of a sudden, and she is outrunning in certain categories. She can't even do all of the running categories of other women. So, you know, she's a natural variant, as is, say, Mark Phelps, who won all these swimming awards because he had unusual he had an unusual gene that affected his shoulder muscle development. So was he not really a fair swimmer because he had this natural variation? No, the Olympics in that level of sports has all sorts of people with physiological differences that are far away from the norm. So the question of how trans fits into that, I agree it's complicated, but it's not unknowable. There have been certain standards set up. It's not crazy.
You know, you raise an interesting point that was raised in another interview I did with a trans-binary individual who they made the argument, well, there are interesting questions about fairness in sports generally. Like, are certain people so good that they shouldn't, you know, be competitive? Why is everyone picking on the trans people? And this was their point. And I feel like that's similar to kind of what you're saying. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it is similar. And I think that there's so many other factors that go into success in sports, including mindset, training.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, when you've been ill the night before. I don't think that if you have trans women competing in certain, or a trans woman competing in certain sports, that they suddenly are going to beat out all of the non-trans women who are competing with them. They might win an event or two now and then, but I don't think they're going to be so different, especially if they're following the rules that the international authorities have set up about hormone regulation for trans competitors.
But then on the other side, I had Dr. Carol Hooven on my podcast recently as well, who studies the science of testosterone at Harvard, and she says that it really does matter. You know, like, testosterone does cause really unfair advantages on the whole. So I hear that perspective as well.
Yeah, I think you find I could refer to you to other experts in testosterone who would argue vigorously with her about that.
Well, that might be an interesting sort of them both. Yeah.
Afterwards, I can give you the names and warts of some other people, because that's not...
I'd appreciate that.
I've seen this doctor's work, and I don't think she's right. But I'm not...
You know what she's talking about. Okay.
I do. Yeah. I'm not the person to make the counter arguments, but there are people out there who are good at it.
Well, I want to be very respectful of your time today. You've given me almost an hour here already. But I want to just leave it open now for you to just... Is there anything else you want to say? Like, what are you excited about right now? I know you're working on a new book. Good luck. Good luck in your new book.
Thank you.
I know how hard it is to write a book. Did you want to just talk any more about where your theory is right now, and just leave our listeners with any final thoughts?
Well, the book that I'm writing is trying to look at how development works in both a biological and psychological sense from infancy on, and how gender, but especially focusing on the first 3 years of life, because that's what I've been working on, how gender is part of development from actually before birth, and how it sort of is always there. So, and I'm trying to work to sort of get rid of the old theories, which are inherently binary, and figure out how we can think about developmental psychology of young children in a more continuous way. But I also want to give a shout out to a whole lot of new scholarship that's coming out by trans scholars, and that have really influenced my work and slowed me down in some ways, because I have to stop and read it. It's not work that I've read previously, and it's coming out quite regularly, and it's really interesting, solid work that's re-theorizing this whole field.
Yeah, I can't keep up. It seems like every week there's a new gender that has been added or something.
That's right. There is.
You know, it's like, it's hard to keep up, but you'll be doing a great service if you can summarize a lot of this and put it so I can just read your book, at least for the time being. It would be helpful. That'd be helpful. I do love footnote. No, and I probably will, because I'm really nerdy. I saw you make a call for the end of the study of sex differences in psychology, and I thought that was fascinating. But I've published papers on sex differences, right? And so that made me pause, and I was like, huh, that's interesting. So do you really think that that language needs to leave the field of psychology, and that we just maybe talk about, what did you call it, gender slash sex?
Gender sex, yeah. I think it does need to leave the field.
Wow, I mean, that's a pretty bold claim there, my friend.
Yeah, well, I've come at it slowly, but I'm locked into it now.
So interesting. I had a biologist say to me, well, yes, sex is a binary from an evolutionary point of view, but evolution also made a lot of variation within each sex, and we need to make that point as well, that it's not just just there being a binary of sex doesn't mean that there isn't a lot of variation within each sex. That so I think maybe we also should make that point as well.
I think that's a very important point, and that's one I want to try and sort of bring up to the surface more as I write in this book.
Mm. Well, great. Wow. Well, it is such an honor to have you here today. I just want to say that the historian of science, Evelyn Hammons, describes you as, quote, one of the most influential feminist scientists of her generation. So to have that on my podcast is quite an honor. So, yeah, I don't know. Did you hear that? Did you hear that you were described as such?
Well, I don't know if I've heard it or not, but I do know Professor Hammons. So I'm very honored that she said that.
Yes. So anyway, thank you so much for being on my podcast and offering your valuable perspective.
You're very welcome. I look forward to seeing / hearing it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.